Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Fellowship of Manhattan. We bid you welcome who come with weary spirit seeking rest. We bid you welcome who come with hope in your heart. We bid you welcome who are seekers of a new faith. We bid you welcome who enter this hall as a homecoming. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. I have a few announcements. Our offertory music will be played by our pianist, Matthew Meals. He will be playing Meditations by Alex Wakeham. Rhapsody number two by List. Okay. I just followed orders from our music chair here. Our speaker today will be Harold Schlechtweg, advocacy coordinator of the International Rescue Committee in Wichita. Joys and concerns cards are at the desk when you come into the fellowship on the right. We had to move it because we have very interesting materials on the other table. Please join us for coffee and conversation after the service. And for other announcements, please refer to the order of service. Jocelyn will be lighting the chalice for us. Let us welcome the stranger, the refugee, the internally displaced, the other. Let us treat them as we would like to be treated. Compassion, mercy, love, and hospitality are for everyone, the native-born and the foreign-born, the member of our community and the newcomer. Let us remember that we are all considered strangers somewhere, that we should treat the stranger to our community as we would like to be treated. Let us remember no refugee leaves his or her homeland without a reason. Some flee because of persecution, violence, or exploitation. Others due to natural disaster. Yet others to provide better lives for their families. Let us recognize that all persons are entitled to dignity and respect as human beings. All those in our country, including the stranger, are subject to its laws, and none should be subject to hostility or discrimination. Let us speak of our own faith without demeaning or ridiculing the faith of others. Let us respect the right of the stranger to practice his or her own faith freely. Let us not keep silent when we see others speaking ill of strangers, judging them without coming to know them, or when we see them being excluded, wronged, or oppressed. Let us light the chalice in the spirit of welcoming the stranger. We are now going to sing our opening hymn, 295, Sing Out Praises for the Journey.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Thank you. We're going to do things a little different. We're going to look up at the wall this morning. The kids probably don't know this because parents have a way of not sharing what they read online. But yesterday, I posted information about this story and the art that's in it, which I think is really striking. So the parents, or some of the adults, already know about this story. It's called Stepping Stones, A Refugee Family's Journey by Marguerite, I think that's how you pronounce it, Roers. And the artwork is by a name that I'm apologizing for not pronouncing correctly, probably, Nisar Ali Badar. Do you guys know the difference between a refugee and an immigrant? Anybody? Yeah.
Is it a refugee trying to get away from a really bad situation in their home country?
Lauren says a refugee is somebody who's trying to get away from a really bad situation. Whereas an immigrant is like just another word for neighbor on some level. It's just a person who lives in a different country. At least that's my take. This story is about refugees. And thank you to Ilka for picking this story. And for Doug for showing me how to use technology. Rama, wake up, the rooster crowed every morning when we still lived at home. From my warm bed, I listened as Mama prepared breakfast. Bread, yogurt, juicy red tomatoes from our garden. Can you read that other language that's down below the English words? Did that work? When I was little, not so long ago, my brother Sammy, our friends, and I played on sun-baked soil. We laughed, ran across rocks and sand, free as birds. When Papa came in from the fields, he would sit for a time under the orange tree and tell stories of our ancestors. What are the pictures made out of? What?
Rocks.
In that not so distant memory, we were free. Free to play, free to go to school, free to buy fruit and vegetables at the market, free to laugh and chat, drink tea with neighbors, always 3 cups. But that was then, and this is now. Back then, Jado, my grandfather, fished. Papa worked in the fields. Mama sewed silk scarves for me and my dolls. Wrapped in silk and hugs, I didn't know our lives would soon change forever. But Jado said we weren't really free. If we're not allowed to sing our songs, to dance our dances, to pray the prayers of our choice, are we truly free? Then war came to our country. Life in our village changed. Nothing was as it had been. Soon there was not enough food. Rama, share this bowl of soup with Sammy. I didn't know then that Mama would go hungry. But we still had Mama's hugs and Jado's arms to hold us. Then the birds stopped singing. People began to leave our village, first a trickle, then a stream, across dusty fields under a burning sun, a stream driven by hope, mothers, fathers, children, seeking a better place, a better life, a river of strangers in search of a place to be free, to live and laugh, to love again, in search of a place where bombs did not fall when people did not die on their way to market, a river of people in search of peace. At first, when our neighbors left, I didn't mind. I had Papa and Mama and Jado and Sammy. I still had friends. We waved goodbye, not knowing they wouldn't come back. But when bombs fell too close to our home, Mama and Papa became frightened for us all. I hid my face in Mama's lap and cried, even though I am a big girl. One day, Jado told Sammy and me that it was time to join the river of people, time to leave all that we knew. That night, I lay in bed and cried because I knew I would never again hear the crow of the rooster, the creak of the gate, the bleat of our goat. I lay awake and listened to the wind, wondering if the moon rises the same way in other places. Sammy and I said goodbye to the flowers in our yard, to our goat, to the soil we called home. Then we walked. We walked and walked and walked. I tried to match my steps to Jado's long strides. I tried to hold Mama's hand, but she carried blankets, a bundle of clothes. I carried only memories in my heart. We walked, sometimes alone, but mostly with many others. Everyone fleeing the war, running away from the bombs. Papa carried little Sammy and more on his back. When I grew so tired and cried, Papa told me we were walking toward a bright new future. We walked to the end of the earth, and when we reached it, there was the sea. We set sail on waves of hope and prayer. I was frightened as the waves battered our little boat, and not everyone made it safely across. We said prayers for those whose journey ended at sea. When we arrived on land once again, Mama and Papa planted seeds to grow flowers to remember those who did not reach freedom. And on we walked, tired. I was so tired. My feet felt like rocks on which we walked. My legs were trees rooted to the soil. On we walked. But now we walked across lands free from war, free from guns and bombs, free from fear. Now we walked in hope. At last we came to our future. New neighbors welcomed us with open arms. I heard their voices but didn't understand their words. I knew what the words meant. Stay, they said. Stay here with us. You will be safe now. No more war. They shared what they had, clothes, food, even a new doll. We have a new home now, a home with new sounds and smells, with smiles and people who help. Will this always be home, or will we go back one day? The lucky ones, they call us. New memories, new hopes, new dreams. Not of war, but of peace. And that's the end. And we could sit here and talk, but this story has me all choked up. So we're going to go back and talk about it. Thank you.
Go to learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
The offertory will now be given and received in grateful appreciation. If you have a joy or concern, you may put it in the basket that will be passed around.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. It was beautiful. We have four joys today. John Exdell is here today with his daughter Sophie Exdell and her friend Nicole, visiting from San Diego, where they also attend the UU. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Bryce and Shirley are celebrating their 35th wedding anniversary today. Cake will be available after the service. Congratulations, Shirley and Bryce. Betty Banner shares a joy. She took so many personal care items to the crisis center. She would like to thank everybody who made a contribution and donated. Thank you. And the emergency shelter as well. Thank you. Anna Franklin announces that she organized a free tango workshop today in Manhattan, and she is very excited about that. We honor all the joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken. And I made a mistake in the order of service.
Home, poem by Worson Shire. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbors running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with, who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory, is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. No one leaves home unless home chases you. Fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burned threads into your neck. And even then you carried the anthem under your breath. Only tearing up your passport in an airport toilet, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear that you wouldn't be going back. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck feeding on newspaper unless the miles traveled mean something more than a journey. No one crawls under fences. No one wants to be beaten, pitied. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching, or prison, because prison is safer than a city of fire. And one prison guard in the night is better than a truckload of men who look like your father. No one could take it, no one could stomach it, no one's skin would be tough enough. The go-home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out, they smell strange, savage, messed up their country, and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks, roll off your backs? Maybe because the blow is softer than a limb torn off. Or the words are more tender than 14 men between your legs. Or the insults are easier to swallow than rubble, than bone, than your child's body in pieces. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of the gun. And no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs, leave your clothes behind, crawl through the desert, wade through the oceans, drown, save, be, hunger, beg, forget pride. Your survival is more important. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave, run away from me now. I don't know what I have become. But I know that anywhere is safer than here.
Saved by a Maharaja, a True Story. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland, signaling the beginning of World War II. As a result of the German invasion, Poland was torn apart and destroyed. Millions of its citizens were held captive in barbaric concentration camps, and countless Polish children were brutally separated from their parents and left orphaned. Overcoming grave obstacles and challenges, many Polish children somehow managed to flee these dire circumstances. Some of these child refugees made an arduous journey across Eastern Europe and the Middle East, finally arriving in India. Having been refused asylum in every single country along the way, one contingent of roughly 1,000 Polish children finally managed to board a ship to Bombay. However, when they arrived at Bombay Harbor, the British governor of Bombay also refused them entry. Remember, back then in the early 1940s, India was still a colony of Britain, and the British made the rules in Bombay, since Bombay was one of their strongholds. This was when a native Indian Maharaja stepped in. His Highness Digvijay Ranjit Singh Jadeja of the small semi-autonomous native kingdom of Nawanagar was frustrated with the British lack of empathy. Therefore, he took matters into his own hands. He invited the ship to dock at a port within his own kingdom, and he personally welcomed the Polish children as his honored guests. From the moment the ship docked, the Maharaja took every conceivable step to make the children as comfortable as possible. The children required education, housing, food, and caretakers. The Maharaja spared no expense in providing these facilities. The Maharaja took many personal risks to ensure that the children found safe haven in his kingdom. The British, of course, protested and threatened the Maharaja with dire consequences for housing foreign refugees on Indian soil without British permission. In response, the Maharaja announced that the Polish children were now legally his own family and formally adopted them as his own children. As a result, the British were not able to do anything about it. The Maharaja took care of the children right through to the end of World War II, following which they were able to either return home to Poland or resettle in Israel and various other Western countries. The Maharaja's gesture was especially inspirational given that despite the fact that India had been invaded, conquered, oppressed, and looted mercilessly by the British, he bore no hatred or xenophobia against white people. Instead, he went out of his way to help white children in distress. The Maharaja's act of generosity is still remembered in Poland. The Polish president posthumously awarded him with the Commander's Cross of the Order of Merit. Poland also named the Maharaja the honorary patron of Warsaw's well-known Bednarska High School. And in 2013, the government of Poland inaugurated the Good Maharaja Square in Warsaw. To me, the story touches a very personal chord since I'm an Indian American who is married to a Polish American.
It's a great honor to speak to you today. I always feel at home when I speak to Unitarian Universalists. I think it's appropriate at this time to call up the memory of James Reeb. Most of you probably know who James Reeb was. He was a Unitarian clergyman, and he was martyred in Selma, Alabama. And on his desk in Boston, where he was employed, he was martyred there with Martin Luther King, of course, at the march of Martin Luther King's call for the March on Selma. And But he, at the time he went there, he was living in Boston. And he had this prayer on his desk. And what he said, what this prayer said was, "Grant us peace fearlessly to contend against evil and to make no peace with oppression, and that we may reverently use our freedom. Help us to employ it in the maintenance of justice among men and nations." For those of us, for those of you here not familiar with the International Rescue Committee, do I need to hit it again? I guess I'm hitting the wrong button. Here it is. There we are. For those, and of course, we all recognize this gentleman, right? For those of us who are not familiar with the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, we are one of nine organizations in the United States who engage in refugee resettlement. In addition, the IRC is an international organization working in refugee camps and hotspots around the world. The IRC was founded in 1932 by prominent individuals, including Albert Einstein, to assist victims fleeing Nazi terror in Europe. We are the largest refugee resettlement organization in Kansas, one of three. These are the nine national organizations. The three in Kansas are Catholic Charities and Episcopal Migration Ministries, as well as the IRC. We are the largest. We have an office in Wichita and one in Garden City, which will soon be closed. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. We opened our office in Wichita in 2011, and since then we've settled more than 1,100 refugees in Wichita and Garden City. I came to work for the International Rescue Committee in October of last year. I'm advocacy coordinator, and as such, I lobby federal, state, and local governments on behalf of refugees. I engage in community activities, community education activities such as those here today. My job is grant-funded, and my visit today is partially paid for by the Kansas Health Foundation. They have a community welfare or community healthy communities grant, and they gave that to IRC, and that makes it possible for me to go out and say things that other members of the IRC can't say because they're funded by the federal government to help resettle refugees. But I have a great deal more freedom when I come and speak for that reason. Today I'm going to first describe two crises. The first is the humanitarian crises of our time. More than 70 million human beings displaced from their homes by war and its ravages. More than 22 million are living outside their countries of origin, many in terrible conditions. The second crisis is a crisis of conscience. With the election of President Trump, our nation has turned its back on a history of bipartisan support. Presidents as different as Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama and all those in between supported refugee resettlement. They did so because they recognized it was both in our national interest and required by values we as a nation hold dear. In discussing this second crisis, the one that affects us in this room most directly, I'm going to directly address the key argument of the administration that we need to harden our hearts and turn refugees away in order to protect the homeland from terrorist attack. I will also briefly address some of the arguments that we might hear at the grocery store, that refugees depend on our taxes for support and are a drag on our economy. And finally, I'm going to list some ways that if you choose to stand with refugees, that you can help. I think it's very easy today to feel hopeless and that there's nothing we can do. I think there are things we can do, And so that's one of the ways I want to end, or that is the way I want to end my talk. Let's see what I have up here next. Who is a refugee? The forced migration of refugees from their homes and countries of origin is the humanitarian crisis of our times. The United Nations defines a refugee as a person who is forced to flee his or her home because of war or political upheaval and seek safety in another country. Let me go back to that for just a second. I should be able to get a second thing to bounce up there. There it is. They have a well-founded reason to fear persecution because of their race, religion, nationality, a membership in a social group, or their political opinion. And refugee status is determined by the United Nations. The refugees that are in this country were first certified as refugees by the United Nations, and then were, of course, required to submit to a very severe vetting process. More than 70 million refugees have been displaced by war. More than 25 million have been driven from their countries of origin, including more than a million Rohingya from Myanmar. This is more than any time in human history. This is from the Syrian war, civil war. More than any time in human history. By way of comparison, in 2001, the year the terrorists destroyed the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York, the world's refugee population was about half what it is today. So in 2001, it was 12 million. By 2005, it had actually declined to 8.7 million, and then it began growing again. And, of course, today we have more than we've ever had before. Refugees who are admitted to the United States are fleeing terrible suffering from war, the destruction of their homes, terrible murders, mutilation, and rape. Who are the victims of this? Who are these refugees? According to the United Nations, more than half of all refugees are children. And according to the U.S. State Department, the majority of refugees admitted to the United States, more than 70% are women and children. This is a refugee camp, refugee women and children getting water. And I will say that our experience in Wichita matches this. We have... If you should come there, and I want to invite any of you to come, but be sure and call me first, and we'll try and figure out the best day. But we have, if you decide to do that, but you will see many women and many, many children who are currently using our services there out of the Wichita office. So many of these... refugees bring a terrible burden with them. They're continuing to suffer PTSD. Some of them have medical issues and concerns, different ways that people can suffer. They seem to have suffered all of them. In the face of this suffering, I should say, refugee resettlement has enjoyed bipartisan support for almost 40 years. We go on, let's don't get ahead of ourselves here. These are presidential determinations. Under the law that was passed in 1980, the President of the United States can determine how many refugees are admitted to the United States each year, and it's done on a fiscal year basis. So these numbers represent the largest number of any fiscal year of that presidency. And Ronald Reagan served 8 years. The most that he admitted during his term, one of his years, was 140,000. George W. Bush, 4 years, 142,000. Bill Clinton, 121,000. That was the largest that he brought in. George W. Bush, it was 80,000. And Barack Obama, this was his last year in office. His presidential determination was 110,000. And that would have been in September of 2016 was when he made that determination. And that was really made in response to the war going on in Syria. Since 1980, the cap on the number of refugees, that's that's what this is. These are all caps, how many the government, the U.S. would accept that year. It has averaged up until last year, it's averaged 95,000. Before 2017, the lowest cap or PD set by any president since 1980 was President Reagan. 1 year, his cap was 67,000. But that was the lowest that he would accept. Even after the destruction of the World Trade Center, President Bush determined the United States could still accept 70,000 refugees. Now, I will say that they did not get 70,000 that year because President Bush revamped the vetting process for bringing for folks coming into this country, and he went to the refugee organizations and said, I'm going to have to change these rules, and that's going to affect, and while we ramp up to do that, we're going to have to retrain our staff, we're going to have to do some other things, increase the number of staff that's vetting refugees, so we aren't going to be able to bring in as many this coming year, but we will come back. And he reassured the refugee resettlement organizations, and that's exactly what happened. Since 1980, Let's go on. Since 1980, the U.S. has admitted more than 3 million refugees without a single terrorist attack. Those who wish to harm our homeland have found it far easier to enter the country on a temporary student visa as a tourist or temporary worker than to navigate the rigors of our refugee vetting process. Okay, so what's happened next? Now we have the election of President Trump. What President Trump did was when he came into office, he was looking at that 110,000 because the fiscal year runs, if you recall, from the 1st of October to the end of September of the next year, right? So the last year of President Obama's administration, he set it at 110,000, which would have carried over into President Trump's term. As soon as President Trump came into office, he said, no, we're not going to take 110,000, and we're certainly not going to take a bunch of Syrians, and we're certainly not going to go along with the vetting process now in place. Remember, that vetting process was designed by Governor Bush, or by President Bush. Anyway, President Trump set it at 50,000 for the 2017 year, which is less than half of the 110,000 that President Obama had set it at. So he immediately cut it in half. The other thing that President Trump did was he imposed a six-month ban on new refugee admissions immediately. So once he came into office, there were no admissions at all for 6 months. And then after that, he reimposed this ban on refugees for two additional 90-day periods, covering 11 countries. So then he said, after that first 6 months, he said, okay, folks can come in, but only from, but not from these 11 countries, nine of which are majority Muslim. Now, this is different from the travel ban. The travel ban was knocked down in courts, but the ban on refugees from these 11 countries was not knocked down in court. And the Supreme Court allowed it to continue, and they just heard arguments, if you've listened to that, on the ban for those 11 countries. And the argument has been that it is actually a Muslim ban, which would violate the Constitution. So the Supreme Court, it's in their hands, but that ban has continued while they're making their decisions. So the 11 countries, nine of which are majority Muslim, are Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Mali, North Korea, Sudan, South Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, as well as stateless refugees, so-called, from Palestinians. And it should be noted that more than half of all refugees worldwide come from just three countries, Syria, Afghanistan, and South Sudan. And also that up until this ban went into effect, 44% of refugees coming into the United States came from banned countries that that have been banned. So we immediately saw an impact of the President Trump's administration and policies on refugee resettlement. How successful have these measures been in limiting immigration? Here's an example. More Syrians were killed in the suspected chemical attack on April 7th. At least 60 were killed at that time. More of them were killed than have been allowed to resettle in the United States this year. By way of contrast, in fiscal year 2016, President Obama's last year in office, the United States admitted 2,000 Syrians, and those were winnowed down from 23,000 applicants through the vetting process that was then in place. For FY 2018, which began October 1st, 2017, we have a new presidential determination, a new cap on refugees at 45,000. And as I said earlier, the average prior to President Trump was 95,000 a year. So it's been dropped to 45,000. Worse than that, at the halfway point of the fiscal year was reached at the end of March. And the United States had admitted only 10,548 refugees. 10,548 refugees. So multiply that by two, and you come up with less than 22,000. IRC expects the United States to actually admit less than 22,000 refugees this year, this fiscal year. And that's in the face of incredible need. The new vetting procedures, primarily this is because, for several reasons, the vetting procedures were changed to make them more difficult to get through. But there's no new staff, even though it's more difficult to process refugees because of increased numbers of questions, more research is being done, more information they have to provide. The staff was not increased to handle that. In fact, the staff was decreased. They took staff away from refugees to assign them to other programs. Secondly, the staff has to be retrained to carry out these new vetting procedures, and there's been no retraining. Very little retraining, not enough. So the end result, together with the ban on certain countries, they have not said, okay, well, we're going to bring in 45,000, so instead of bringing them in from Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan or Yemen, we will bring them in from Republic of Congo, a number of refugees have come in to our... But they didn't do that. They didn't increase the number from the Republic of Congo, which they easily could have done because the need is there. So we're looking at 22,000 refugees, probably less, slightly less than that. Let's see what I got next. You can see the line. You can also see what the impact has been here in Kansas. It's pretty much mirrors what's happening nationally. We have seen a tremendous drop in the number of refugees, and I have some numbers out there, but I will tell you that in 2016, the fiscal year 2016, or fiscal year 2017, we saw the numbers cut in half coming into Kansas, and we saw that happen again this year. The highest number of refugees resettled in Kansas in any one year was in Obama's last full fiscal year. It was about 950 refugees. And the next year they were cut by half, and this year they've been cut by half again. We have received so far this, as of the end of March, 152 refugees in Kansas. And I said that's half of what we got in 2017, which was half of what we got the year before. So we're seeing a drastic, it's just falling off the chart, as you can see up there. The administration's policies and new vetting procedures are also limiting resettlement in Kansas. The IRC's Garden City office is closing because the State Department will no longer support locations that resettle less than 100 refugees in a year. So that office is slated to close the 1st of September. And I will say that we have settled a tremendous number of refugees from Somalia and Ethiopia that live in Garden City, and they are able to go to work there in the meatpacking industry, which, you know, I wouldn't want to work in a meatpacking industry, but I will say this for companies like Tyson. They pay you more than the minimum wage. They get health insurance after 6 months. They have folks there that are able to become supervisors. I talked to someone from Tyson. I said, well, what do you say that these Somalis are taking American jobs, right? And he says, hey, he says, anybody that walks into my company here and can fill out an application and pass the physical, I hire them on the spot. He says, we have a labor shortage. He said, that's just the kind of talk that goes around, you know, in a, out here in the restaurants. If people wanted those jobs, they got them. He said, all they have to come out here and do is apply for them. And Tyson has been one of our better employers, quite frankly, better than some of the ones in Wichita. We have higher wages for refugees are higher in Garden City than they are in Wichita, higher than they are in Kansas City, in fact. And that's a reflection, really, of labor shortage in western Kansas, frankly. Let me go on here. I started volunteering for the IRC because I read about the Afghans and Iraqis who put their lives on the line working for the U.S. government that were being resettled through the refugee program. Now, I volunteered as an ESL person for a couple of years before I did this. Here, too, the Trump administration has fallen short breaking faith with those who were told they would have a safe haven if their work for us put them and their families in harm's way. Here's an example of how far we've backpedaled. In 2017, the United States admitted 3,051 Iraqis who had worked for our military or as contractors. And so far in 2018, the number is 36. So, you know, if we double that, we get, what, 72? It's incredible. It's also incredible if you look at the waiting list, which is 60,000. David Miliband, president and CEO of the IRC, is not a man given to hyperbole. Here's his assessment. At a time of widespread need, the United States is in headlong retreat from the principles and practices that for so long have made it a global beacon. It is not an exaggeration to say that if the current trends continue, the U.S. government will have no refugee resettlement at the end of this administration. Miliband goes on to say in the same article that the U.S. is rigging the admissions system to ensure that the number of refugees admitted will be far below whatever cap the administration sets for public relations purposes. The two, now I want to talk about a little bit about refugees not being a threat. And these are all U.S. government emblems of our different security agencies. The Trump administration argues that its policies are necessary to safeguard the homeland from terrorist acts. Make no mistake, the IRC supports rigorous safeguards to entry by terrorists through the Refugee Resettlement Program. I'm a veteran. I certainly wouldn't support a program that allowed terrorists in the United States. The vetting process before additional bureaucratic red tape of the Trump administration added was rigorous and thorough. Without heel dragging, the vetting process in place when President Trump took office averaged 2 years from the time of application for a refugee to actually get to the United States. 2 years. That was the average time, and they weren't dragging heels. They were doing an investigative process. Security agencies, and these are those up there, the FBI, the Office of Counterterrorism, the State Department, and the Defense Department, hand-select those refugees who will be allowed to settle in the United States. The selection process involves in-person interviews, forensic document testing, sophisticated biometric testing, and interagency checks. If there's any doubt at all that a refugee may be a threat to the safety and security of the United States or citizens, that refugee is rejected. For example, under the rules in place during the Obama administration, the United Nations certified 23,000 Syrian refugees as eligible for resettlement in the United States. That is, these were applicants that the UN checked them out and said, yeah, they are indeed refugees, according to the definition. And that was out of a total of 4 million refugees. So there's plenty of people out there if somebody doesn't make the grade or doesn't complete the testing, there's always somebody else in line. That's not an issue. Reports from IRC field offices abroad, other refugee and humanitarian organizations, and the United Nations are consistent. The United States has not retrained staff or increased existing numbers of staff to vet refugee applicants using the new onerous standards. The result is a steep slowdown in the number of refugees approved for resettlement in the United States. Just as they're not a threat, neither are they a drag on the economy or a burden on taxpayers. Refugees pay their own way. Until I came to work for the IRC, I did not know that refugees have to repay the cost of their transportation in the United States. They have to repay for their plane flight, and they have to start repayment within 6 months of their coming to the United States. We pretty much get them into jobs by the time they've been here for 6 months, and they have to begin repaying what's considered a loan, and that can be very expensive. If you've got a big family, I have heard it actually being as high as $6,000. A government report that was initiated during the Obama administration but completed after President Trump took over found that over the past decade, refugees paid $63 billion more in taxes than they received in benefits. The study found that by the time refugees have been in the country at least 25 years, their median family income reaches $67,000, which is $14,000 more than the median family income for all American families. In conclusion, the world's refugee crisis is only growing worse. We see whole populations fleeing, as in the uncontrolled migration into Europe from the Middle East and the more recent migration of Rohingya Muslims out of Myanmar. It is in the national interest of the United States to assist refugees and a moral imperative. President Trump has turned his back on more than 35 years of bipartisan support for refugee resettlement in the United States. His decisions, such as capping the number of refugees can be admitted, barring refugees from majority Muslim and other countries, and adding to the bureaucratic red tape and hoops refugees are forced to jump through, are reducing the numbers of refugees admitted to the United States even further. More than this, his actions limiting refugee admissions, encourage those countries and those political movements around the globe to do likewise. These actions have not made the United States safer. They've only served to make the lives of refugees, the majority of whom are women and children, more miserable and threatened. I begin by talking about James Reeb, and his commitment not only to citizens in this country but to the world. I'd like to end with a quote by Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King, who's called James Reeb, had answered. This is a quote: "On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it expedient? And then expedience comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? Conscience asks the question, is it right? There comes a time when one must take the position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he or she must do it because conscience tells him or her that it is right." Martin Luther King. So what can you do? Here's a family arriving, wrapped in the flag. Take action. We have this flyer outside here. Does anybody in here that does not own a smartphone? Okay, good for you. Anybody else? A couple, three? Oh, wow, I should have known. I'm in with Unitarians. She could have guessed it. I went for years and didn't have one, but about 2 years ago I got a smartphone. But here's the reason if you do have one. Here's the reason to get one if you decide you want to do it. Not for all the distraction that it causes, but you can text this number right here. You can text RESCUE to 738674, just that number, 738674. If you type in RESCUE, what that will do is that will put you into a database. And when things happen or when there's a need for citizens to raise their voice, you get a text and you'll say, will you call this number and talk to your elected representative? And if you call that number, you put in your zip code and they automatically connect you with a congressman or a senator. And then you can just say, hey, I think you ought to do what's right and hire refugees. And I said, we do have a flyer out there and on the thing. But that's it works fine. I get it. And one of the things I'm trying to do in Kansas is I'm trying to increase the number of people who are on this. The last I heard, which was about 6 months ago, I need to check again, was about we had 40 regular texters or 40 regular callers based on that text number. And, you know, you'll get it. And if you don't want to do anything with it, you can just delete it. But if you do get it, and all you got to do is push the tap it, and it automatically calls that number, and then you put in your zip code, and then it'll call your congressman for you, and you can leave a message. And I have left a message for my congressman, Ron Estes, from 4th Congressional District. You guys are you in one? I will tell you this, of our congressional delegation, Marshall has been the most sympathetic to refugees, quite frankly. In January, I went to Washington, and Marshall was the only congressman that actually met with us. So, now, his office includes Garden City, by the way. And Garden City has been very supportive of refugees, and so have the employers out there. So that's probably part of it. But he did meet with us, and of course we're going to close that. So that's one thing you can do. You can respond when you get the text by calling in. You can become a member of IRC, a sustaining donor. We have a flyer out there again on the table. If you want to make a regular contribution, comes off your credit card or out of your bank account, you can do that. You can organize another community meeting here in Manhattan. I'll come back. Maybe Kristen will too. This is Kristen. She's one of our workers. She helps with volunteers and collections and stuff. You can write a letter to your local newspaper, and here's the deal. I'll make a deal with you. If you write a letter, I'll help you with, if you want facts, I'll provide you with facts. I'll even give you feedback on your letter before you send it in. Right now, we are asking for people to contact their legislators and to write in and to point out the decrease in the number of refugees and encouraging the administration to live up to its word and bring in the numbers, at least that it said it would, which were 45,000. So I think I've finished.
We only have a few minutes left, but if anybody has a burning question. Yes. Thank you.
We'll be hanging around.
Yes, and if we cannot get all the questions done, we have coffee hour coming up. So I do not see any hand signs at this point. Again, thank you very much. We will now sing our closing hymn, which is number 146. To all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than you know.